Welcome back to Roaming with Restless Women. I am so excited for this guest this week, you guys. I'm telling you are just going to be blown away by this woman and her accomplishments. I'm just thrilled to have found her, and I'm thrilled she decided that she could spare some time for us because she has a lot of wisdom to share. Her name is Sharon Betty Presler. Betty is her call sign, and we'll explain that in just a minute. I found Sharon when I read a great piece on LinkedIn, and she talked about meritocracy and how false that notion really is, especially as it applies to the military, at least in her experience, for sure. It moved me so much that I reached out to see if she'd be willing to share that story and others. And let me tell you a little bit about her from her bio. Sharon was handpicked as one member of the initial cadre of women fighter pilots in the United States Air Force. She's a fighter pilot. Ah, I can't believe it. She was the first woman to fly the F-16, a single-seat, single-engine fighter, and the first woman to fly combat missions and instruct in the F-16. Now, okay, if that hasn't blown you away. She has 1,300 hours in the F-16, including over 50 combat hours in Iraq, and one ejection due to electrical failure. That makes me scared just thinking about it. In her 20 years of service in the U.S. Air Force, she was also a navigator and piloted a Learjet. She also spent time in the North American Aerospace Defense Command, writing our homeland defense plans after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, plans that are still in use today, so far. We don't know what's going to happen next. She also spent time in the North American Air. Whoops, I already talked about that. After retiring from the Air Force in 2006, Sharon went to work for Southwest Airlines, where she flew over 9,000 hours in a Boeing 737. And she retired as a captain from Southwest Airlines in 2020. Sharon is a professional speaker, focusing on inclusion, motivating people to follow their dreams and determine how they can live their best lives. She's also a transition coach, an adjunct professor at Grand Canyon University, and volunteers with foster youth. So a very, very busy woman. Welcome, Sharon, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you, Julian. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, I'm just so excited. You just can't even believe. Okay, so tell me, first of all, what prompted you to write about meritocracy
So,
in the
yeah, I will say that as a veteran, I'm always following what goes on in the military, and I was not super excited about Secretary Hegseth becoming the Secretary of Defense. Just because of his limited experience with the military and policy and, national level decisions. But I was gonna let that go. And then there was the aircraft crash where the helicopter ran into the Endeavor airplane in DC, which was
Yes.
tragic. But when I heard President Trump at the press conference blame it on DEI, that was the trigger for me. I just couldn't be quiet anymore. So,
Yeah.
since then I've been quite vocal about what I think about DEI, about meritocracy, about lots of changes that are happening in the Department of Defense.
So give us a flavor of what that article, what points that you made. That would be really resonate, particularly with women veterans.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't think we have a true meritocracy anywhere in the world, and the military is no different. It's structured as a meritocracy, but it doesn't really end up that way. And there's lots of reasons for that, but part of it is because we're people, right? And we have biases and we have things that are important to us that maybe aren't important to others. And promotions and job opportunities are based on performance, but also what people write about your performance, which is where the unconscious bias can sometimes come in, right? So, as a fighter pilot, I dealt with lots of people who didn't think women should be fighter pilots. Luckily, it's pretty much a performance-based industry. So, once I proved I could fly the jet, people were more receptive. But still, there's opportunities that are limited. You know, there's good and bad that comes with being. For me, I was pretty much the only woman pilot on my base everywhere I went, except my last assignment. Right. So there's good and bad that comes with that. Everybody knows what you're doing, which is great if you're doing well, and not so great if you're not doing well. Right. Because everybody knows when you mess something up as well. But my pitch on meritocracy was really that the system is flawed. So take pilot training, for example. The way we select people for pilot training, one of the things that's important is if they have their civilian pilot's license, or if they've have, I think they can get up to 10 extra points in the whole merit-based system for having flight hours, right? Well, half this country can't afford to go fly a private airplane, right? It's very expensive. $150 an hour or so to get your private license takes about 50 hours. So do the math. It's an expensive thing. So that's one way that our meritocracy sets up greater chance of success for people with money, right? That's just one example. And then if you look at the physical requirements, the minimum height to be a pilot in the Air Force is 5'4". That is the average height of women in the U.S. So half of the women are not eligible to be pilots in the Air Force. Other ways that it comes about is, especially as you get higher in rank, you know, when you go to look at things like being a squadron commander or being a group commander, that's, although there's not a lot of politics in the military, I'll say those are kind of political positions because there's lots of people that are qualified for the one job that everybody wants. And there's no real way, I don't think, to say, well, just choose the best qualified. Well, it's not that simple, right? Because part of your qualification is how are you going to work with your other squadron commanders? How are you going to work with the people that you work for, the operations group commander or the wing commander? You know, it's not just about your performance in that job. And this will be the first time you've really had a large command like that. So there's no performance track record to base selection on. So it does come down sometimes to who you know and who you've worked with before, because then you have a personal link, a personal example of how their work ethic is and what they do, as opposed to just reading about them on a piece of paper. So that's another place that meritocracy kind of falls apart.
And so why did you decide to become a fighter pilot to begin with?
Well, I actually decided to become a pilot when I was a little girl and I went on my first airplane ride. My mom was born in England and my dad was going, is in the Air Force and he was going to Thailand during the Vietnam War. So we flew back to my mom's native country of England. And on that flight, I was just amazed by everything. Flying through clouds, you know, they look like they're solid, but they're not. And then they took us, it was an overnight flight, and they took us up to the cockpit, the stewardesses did. And when they opened that cockpit door, I was looking out over the Atlantic Ocean at like a billion stars. And it was just amazingly beautiful. And I was so excited. I went running back to my seat. Mommy, 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 I want to be a stewardess. And she laughed. And luckily for me, my mom was decades ahead of where a lot of women were, because this was probably 1969. And she looked at me and she asked me why. And I told her about the beautiful sky. And she said, well, honey, maybe you should be a pilot. And I'm like, what's a pilot? Because we'd been talking with the stewardesses the whole time, right? I'm 4 years old. What do I know? And she said, they're the ones sitting up front staring at that beautiful sky. I'm like, yes.
What
So
a
that's what I wanted to
beautiful
do
story.
from really that time on. Yeah.
Oh my
Yeah.
goodness, 4 years old. Wow. And so, did you consider the challenges or the obstacles when you decided to go into the Air Force?
Yes, but once again, I wanted to fly. Flying is very expensive. Our family didn't have any money. So I got an ROTC scholarship to pay for most of my college, and I got commissioned in the Air Force, and I wanted to go be a pilot. And I didn't think about obstacles then. I just was trying to do what I wanted to do. You know how it is when you're 20 years old, you can do anything, right? So,
So,
yeah, but unfortunately, the Air Force had different plans for me, and I became a navigator, which is someone who basically sits in the airplane and gives directions, if you will. This is before GPS, right? And we would actually look at the stars and the sun and figure out our position and that kind of things. So that was my job for my first 3.5, 4 years in the Air Force. But then once I got in the Air Force, I had a little extra money and I got my private pilot's license. So I kept asking the Air Force. They would do these selection processes every 6 months or a year where they would select people to transition from their current job in the Air Force to pilot training. And so I kept applying for that, and eventually they selected me to go to pilot training. So
Do you
that was
remember how many times you had to apply?
it was my third time.
So you were pretty persistent.
I am definitely persistent.
That's great. So tell me about the first time that you actually took one up by yourself.
Oh yeah, so in pilot training,
Either
with
way, with the
F-16.
first time.
Oh, so the very first time was in a little Cessna 152, right? Because I was getting my private pilot's license, and you have to solo, you have to fly by yourself. And it was fun and scary at the same time, right? Because you're new at this, and now you're by yourself, so it's all on you, right? The instructor's not there to tell you if you're doing something wrong or to help you if you're messing up, and that's it. It's a challenging feeling. It can be a little nerve-wracking, but I loved it. I mean, once I got comfortable, I was fine. I had good instruction and I was confident in what I could do, so it made it a lot easier.
So what about the first time in the F-16? What was different?
That's amazing. So the F-16, I try to describe it to people, and it's like, to me, it's like having your own private roller coaster, right? If you ride roller coasters, you get that feeling where you get all pushed down in your seat, right? That's what pulling G's is like. And 1G is what we have at normal on the earth at all times. That's what keeps us from falling off. And then roller coasters do about 3, 3.5 G's max. And the F-16 can do 9 G's. So if you're not paying attention and you're not, we have a straining maneuver we do to keep the blood from pooling in the bottom half of our body while we're pulling G's. So if you're not paying attention and you get behind on that, you can actually lose consciousness in the airplane. And that's, of course, not a good thing. So, but I loved pulling G's. I loved being able to go upside down. I absolutely loved it. And that first flight in F-16 was just, it came after such a struggle. I mean, I really struggled in F-16 training. I will freely admit that. And the majority of the struggle, I think, was based on pressure, external pressure, because I was the only woman and the first woman. And then internal pressure, because I really felt like, right or wrong, if I didn't do well, then women weren't going to get to fly fighters anymore. Right? So that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself. Yes. And there were things that were going on, like my squadron commander had to report to the 4-star general in charge of training about my performance weekly. So there was some realism to the pressure.
So was that different for the guys?
Oh yeah, nope, they didn't, nobody knew who the guys were. They didn't have to. I mean,
So they
you
didn't get
only,
reported on every week.
oh no, just me.
Oh, that's just great.
Yeah,
That's just
exactly. Like I said,
great.
everybody knows what you're doing. If you're doing good, it's great. If you're not doing good, it's not so great.
And so how did you wind up in Iraq? Like, in combat, because
Yeah,
I
so after I.
remember that time and they were still fighting about whether women should be in combat roles, period.
Right. So the law changed in 92. Department of Defense policy, I think Air Force policy changed in 93. And I got to my first combat assignment. So fighter squadrons are either training or they're combat ready, right? And so I went to Spengdahlem Air Base in Germany and was in the 22nd Fighter Squadron. And we were responsible for, this was after the first Gulf War, and we were enforcing the no-fly zones over Iraq. So we would take off from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, and we'd fly into Iraq, and we would just keep our eyes out for anybody flying, doing circles. And they would sometimes, we would have live missiles, live guns, and sometimes our airplanes would get lit up by, the lit up being targeted by the surface air missiles on the ground. When I
And
was
could you
there, I
tell
never, I
that?
mean,
Like
pardon me?
when that happens, like in the movies or in Star Wars, you can tell that you've been lit
Yeah,
up.
you have a warning system that tells you when you're being targeted, so
Holy
you react
crap.
accordingly. Yeah, I mean, honestly, people, there's a lot of women that I know that have I'll say much better, much more dramatic combat stories than mine. All right, when I was there, it was relatively boring, which is, both good and bad, depending on what you want. So, but
Right.
it's combat time. You're flying over a foreign country and they have missiles pointed at you. So,
That's still got to be scary. Now, how many people are in a squadron?
there's generally about 25 to 30 pilots in a squadron.
Okay, and when you head out, do y'all all head out at the same time, or
No.
are you like there's little teams?
Yeah, we would generally fly the smallest, combat unit in the F-16 would be a four ship. So you have four airplanes flying together and they'll have a particular mission, whether it's, targeting is something on the ground, patrolling something in the air, those kind of things. And then when
Okay.
we would do what's called large force exercises, or it's really a large, like when we were in Iraq, there's this large air tasking order that includes tankers and, refueling airplanes and radar, air warning airplanes and other fighters and all sorts of things, right?
Wow.
Everybody has their place in this large force that's going to fly into Iraq.
So it's a the choreography, I'm sure, is amazing.
Oh,
To
yeah.
have all of
Yes.
that stuff put together, and you have to
Yes.
know, it's like being on a football team, I guess. You have to know what position are you playing and when do you move.
Yes, exactly.
Wow,
Yep.
that's
Yeah.
amazing. Tell me about when you had to eject.
Oh, yeah. So the F-16 was having a streak of engine problems when I was out. I went back to Luke Air Force Base out in Arizona as an instructor pilot. So I was teaching brand new graduates from pilot training how to fly the F-16, which I absolutely loved. It was one of my best assignments. But in this particular instance, I had an electrical problem. And without going into to too much detail, essentially, unbeknownst to me, because it had never happened in the F-16 before, the electrical problem I had made my brakes and my hook and my radios not work. So I came back, I knew my radios didn't work, and I landed at Luke Air Force Base. And the way you land the F-16, you hold the nose off the runway, and you aero brake until about 100 knots or so, and then you slowly lower the nose, and then you hit your brakes and you start slowing down. Well, I hit my brakes and my feet went straight to the floor and nothing happened.
Holy
So
cow.
this is something we train for. Is there's an emergency procedure for this that's it's called a it's CAPS or bold face. Essentially, it's memorized, right? Because you don't have time to start looking through your checklist.
Right.
So I did all the things I was supposed to do. I went to channel two, stepped on the brakes, nothing happened. I turned the anti-skid off, stepped on the brakes, nothing happened. I put the hook down. My hook didn't come down because that's the same electrical part of my jet that wasn't working, where they put all the important stuff like radio, brakes, and hook. So I basically was going off the end of the runway at about 70 knots, with no way to stop. And if you've ever seen an F-16, they're the coolest looking jet,
Oh,
sleek
yeah.
in the air, right? But on the ground, they're kind of wobbly. Their landing gear are really narrow and they kind of bounce around.
Oh.
So what you're told in the F-16 when you start training is if you're going to depart the prepared surface, so like off the taxiway or something, at greater than taxi speed, which is only about 15 or 20 knots, then you need to eject because it's unstable and it can flip over, it can catch fire, all these
Oh,
things, right?
so you
So sure
don't
enough,
go back up and eject, do you? You
no,
have to eject right
from the
there, that
ground.
close to the ground.
I was on the ground, I was going about 70 knots, and I was so at the end of the runway, they have what's called an overrun, which is about another 1,000 feet of asphalt. And then on this particular runway at Luke, there's some dirt, a little berm that surrounds the inner perimeter fence. There's a concrete drainage ditch. There's an outer perimeter fence, and then there's Northern Avenue, which is a public road.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I was approaching the end of the overrun at about 70 knots when I pulled the handles to eject, or the handle with both hands, just pull up, and it's I've never experienced temporal distortion before, but it just seemed like time slowed down, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, but it's like somehow your brain slows everything down so that you can, and you just remember every single detail,
Oh
right?
yeah.
So what the whole process from me landing to ejecting probably took less than 5 seconds, but it seemed like a long time. And then ejecting to when I started moving seemed like forever, right? I pulled the handle and it seemed like nothing was happening and nothing was happening. And then
Oh.
I could smell It's the rocket motor that is under our seat. It smells like fireworks, right? So it's cordite. I smelled that, and then I saw the black and gray smoke billowing up by my feet, and then I finally started moving. So I was relieved that my ejection seat was working when nothing else important seemed to. But the other thing that happens when you eject is you're subjected to about 13 G's. You know, I told you I love G, but 13 is too much for anybody. So momentarily, the blood is not kept up in your brain enough for you. So I was conscious, but I couldn't see.
Oh
So
my gosh.
I knew I was moving, but I didn't know, you know, exactly what was going on. And then as that acceleration stops, you have a drogue chute that pulls the seat away from you and deploys your parachute. And you can, as soon as the acceleration stops, you can see again. I feel all that happening. I get my parachute. I look up like you're supposed to. You're taught from very early on, canopy, visor, mask, seat kit, LPU. It's what you check for, right? So I look at my canopy. I'm like, yes, good canopy. I flip my visor up. I take my mask off. And then I get distracted because my airplane I can see below me is scooting across the ground as fast as could be. So I realize that that's happening, and just long enough for me to realize that the ground is getting very close very quickly. And I hit the ground. I did not do a good parachute landing fall. So I landed with my feet and then went straight back on my rear end and then hit my head against the ground. Now I still had my helmet on, so my head didn't get hurt, but I did crack my tailbone in the process. Yeah, that's a very
Ouch.
painful thing if you've never done that. It
Yes.
takes forever to heal.
Oh my goodness. Oh my
My
goodness. Well,
poor little airplane, it hit that little berm I told you about in front of the fence, and it got airborne again. And it drug 300 feet of the inner perimeter fence on its landing gear, across Northern Avenue and landed in a farmer's field.
but and it didn't hit
Yeah.
any cars, right?
Didn't hit any cars,
Oh, thank
luckily.
goodness.
Yeah.
Golly, that's what I would. I mean, oh, I think I could handle myself getting hurt. I don't know that I could have hand I could handle something that, of course, it was not your fault, but
Right.
something that had been involved in and then hurting somebody else on the
Yeah,
ground. That'd be
nope.
awful.
But
Oh my goodness.
the airplane was a total loss. It broke the when it hit into the farmer's field, it broke the spine of the airplane, actually the backbone. So it
Yeah.
could not be repaired.
Okay. But you didn't get any demerits for that, did you?
No, I was back
Okay.
flying 11 days later. That's the soonest I could actually sit still for an hour and a half on my cracked tailbone. So that's when I went home.
Oh my goodness. So you have parlayed all of this wonderful experience into your teaching and, you know, your coaching and your volunteering. Tell me how, what have you brought from those experiences into the work that you're doing now? What are the like
Yeah.
two or three
So,
things?
as you said, persistence and resilience, right? How to really how to block out the naysayers, right? I had a personal mantra that I adopted. I didn't make it up, but I adopted it when I was in F-16 training, and it's those who matter don't mind, and those who mind don't matter. And it was just
Oh,
a
I
way to
like
remind
that.
myself that all the people that didn't want me there, all the people that were being negative and hoping for me to fail, they didn't matter to me, and I could ignore them, right? And that's a really valuable lesson. If you can internalize that, that gives you all sorts of freedom to do all sorts of things. And then
Right.
also, I really, going back to fly after ejecting was a good lesson in developing courage.
Yeah.
Because I had never been afraid before in the F-16, but after that day, I was. Right? Because everything, nothing ever happened before, and we're just so well trained, and our maintenance is so good, you don't expect it. You know, it's a possibility, but you just don't focus on it, right? Well, that was kind of hard not to focus on. So going back to fly was a good lesson in developing courage, and I talked to people about that as well. So those are kind of the big three, and it's just a matter of I really like to encourage people, no matter their age or their gender or whatever, to actually go for the things they want in life, right? Going for something and failing is way better than the regret of never trying.
That's true. And
So
I think
that's.
the whole the mantra that you just said also plays into that as
Yeah, it
well.
does.
Because if you're somebody like myself, I am totally convicted of this. I care what I used to care more, but I still care what other people think about me. And I don't want to be seen as a failure. But when you put that mantra into place and you say, this isn't for anybody else, this is for me. I'm going to live my dream, and part of my dream is helping other people live their dream. So, it really takes those naysayers out of play at that
It
point.
does. And that's huge, right? Because even like let's say the worst happened and I did fail out of F-16 training, which I didn't do. I did quite well after I left Luke. But I knew in my heart that I had done my absolute best, right? And if you can do that, if you can do your best, take your best shot at something, even if it doesn't work out, you should be proud of yourself,
Absolutely.
right? Just for having the
Absolutely.
courage to try and to put in the work. So that's part of my so we talked about I speak about encouraging people to follow their dreams, right? Inclusion is another piece because being the only for so long, I understand the impact of inclusion. And when you feel like part of the team and part of the unit, you perform so much better than when you feel like you're an outsider, right? So inclusion in
Totally.
corporations and in businesses and in the military, to me, is not, there's a lot of focus on DEI. I like to focus on the I, right? Because if you can be inclusive, you're going to get the best out of people,
Well, and
right?
the other two tend to fall off,
Yeah.
right?
Well, you'll build diversity naturally if you're inclusive.
Naturally,
Because the
yes.
people that you have that work for you that are different are going to be wanting, they're going to be more likely to stay, right?
Well,
Because they
and they're
feel
one of
valued and they
you.
feel like they belong. Yeah.
100%.
So that, and the other one is, so fighter pilots are really well known for debriefing things. Our jets are expensive and we don't get to fly as much as we want to. So we, after we fly, we come back and we look at the tapes, we record everything, and then we analyze what we did and what we could do better next time, and we try to learn lessons, right? So when I say I encourage people to live their best life, one of the things I try to teach is how to debrief things, right? When you have some pivotal event in your life that either went well or it didn't go well, either way, if you take the time to just do a little analysis of that, you can figure out what worked, what didn't work, and what you can do better next time, right? And if we would spend a little more time doing that with just our personal lives, I know people do it in businesses, right? But if you do it with your personal life as well, you can make better choices and you can be happier.
And I think a lot of times, coaching, since I'm an executive coach or and a lifestyle coach for women, that is what they have the hardest time with, is if they do fail, if they do, have a big bump or something happens, is if you don't have a group of close friends that can help you debrief it. Women need other women to debrief with, and I
Yes.
love how you said that. It's just, but you have to learn how to do it. Some people can do it by themselves, but I know very, very, very few of those people.
Yeah.
I know that I'm lucky enough to have, groups, different groups of supportive people that I can debrief with and that allow me to be vulnerable and honest with myself as well as with them without judgment.
Yes.
And that matters so much. So
Right.
much.
But if you don't take the time to do that, right, then you're more likely to repeat your mistakes.
A
And
hundred
none of us like to fail, right? None of us
percent.
like to do poorly. So it's so much better if we can learn those lessons, right? And move forward and retain your confidence. Because once you, if you fail at something, but then you thoroughly truly understand why and you know what to do different next time, it doesn't impact your confidence as much,
Oh, that
right?
is
Because you
beautiful.
learned,
Yes. Because,
right? And you,
yes.
so it's easier to go forward and keep striving, if you will.
100%. Well, I have three final questions that I'm going to ask you. But
Right.
before I do that, I want to ask you for one, if you have any questions of me or if you have any words of wisdom for our audience.
Well, words of wisdom. I've kind of told you what I think about that already. I just encourage you. I would say don't choose what you want to do based on others' expectations. Right. So don't go out and try to be the first at something because you think it'll be cool, because it's not nearly as cool as you think, especially if it's not something you love. Right. So make conscious choices about your life and what you want to do with it. And then don't let people hold you back. And don't let
Absolutely.
yourself hold you back.
And there will always be a negative Nelly in your life. Just let them go.
Always. If you're doing something worthwhile, there's always going to be someone who tells you you shouldn't be doing it.
Oh,
Always.
100%.
If nobody's telling you that, then you're not doing anything.
Exactly. Okay, so here are my last three questions. If you will please close your eyes, and I'm going to say a couple of words. When I say those words, I'd like for you to then open your eyes and describe what you see in your mind. Wise woman.
Did you say why or wise?
Wise woman.
Okay. I just see pictures of a lot of women that have influenced my life. My
Oh.
mom, my high school softball and volleyball coach, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I love some of her quotes. Just women that have made a difference and impacted lives, right? And
Yeah.
that's kind of what I'm doing. It's more of my focus now after I retired from Southwest Airlines. I'm very still connected with the women fighter pilot community and helping be an advocate for them. I'm working with, like you said, foster youth. I'm trying to help them, get some of the lessons that they don't get, growing up in a group home, right? As hard as the group homes try, some of them are great, but you still can't replace, you have four people rotating in, parenting, 10 kids. It's going to be
Yeah,
rough.
exactly. Thank you for that. Where do you like to roam, Sharon?
All sorts of places. I'm a huge
Okay.
traveler.
Oh, good.
I love Europe, probably because it's easier than, like, we went to Japan, for 2 weeks, my husband and son and I absolutely loved it, but it's very tiring
Oh,
mentally
yeah.
because you can't even read the signs, right? Because their characters are different than our alphabet. So it just becomes, everything is just that much harder, right? So just, I get the feeling of what it's like to be functionally illiterate, I think, because you're just trying to match up symbols, on your, where you're supposed to go and what the menu looks like. So that was, so I like Europe. I love traveling around the United States. I'm hoping to get back to Canada soon. I made a lot of good Canadian friends when I worked at NORAD, and I'd like to go see them.
Oh, cool. Okay, and what makes you restless in a good way?
Well, if you ask my family, I retired from Southwest Airlines and instantly got myself three jobs. So
Yeah.
I guess it's that I like to keep contributing. I like to there's just so many people in the world that need help, right?
100%,
The
100%.
now that I have the time, right? Since I don't have a real job, I can do what I want to do, and that's really been helping people. So I love my coaching. I am working with a few young women who are getting ready to go to college or are in college and trying to figure out what they want to do. I love working with the foster youth, and I really enjoy speaking, especially when I got the opportunity to speak at a few universities, and that's fun. That's kind of the group that I love to talk to because they're at that point where it's going to have the bigger impact on them. If they decide to have the courage to follow their dreams, that's going to matter at age 20 or 25, more than it is at 60 like me.
Same here. Oh, well, thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on. You are just so inspiring and you have so much wisdom to share. And I really, really, really appreciate your sharing it with our audience. I think we're going to get a whole lot out of it.
Thanks, Julie. I appreciate you having me.
All right.